This is Whitley Strieber. I'd like to talk a little bit about my thoughts about John Mack and my relationship with John. Before you listen to this interview that I did with him in November of 1999, John was one of the most extraordinary, most brilliant, and most vital people I ever knew. 5 years after this interview was done in September of 2004, John would die, the victim of a drunk driver, supposedly, in London. John had been a very successful man before he came to the Close Encounter and abduction experiences. He was a Pulitzer Prize winner. He was a brilliant psychiatrist. He was a star at Harvard. But then he decided, after listening to Close Encounter witnesses that had been brought to him by Bud Hopkins, that these people weren't fantasizing. And that took him way out of the mainstream, as far out of the mainstream as you can get in this world. The last group of people in the world that it is politically correct to mock are us, the Close Encounter witnesses and the abductees. It's okay to laugh at us because of what happened to us, and believe me, the media loves to do it even to this day. John Mack stopped laughing, basically, because he was listening to people, as he put it to me, narrating experience. They weren't narrating dreams or fantasies. He said, I've been around people telling me their dreams all of my career, and these people are not talking about dreams. This got him into tremendous trouble at Harvard. He called me in despair one day saying, I think I'm about to lose my tenure and my license to practice psychiatry. I said, John, that's unbelievable. It's unpardonable. It's evil. And he said, yes, it is, actually. I would agree with you there. Before he got into this, I don't think John had experienced human evil or human cruelty on the scale that it is experienced by Close Encounter witnesses and those who give them support. A couple of months before the interview in September, John had been in Time magazine in one of the most unscrupulous and ugly hatchet jobs done on anybody in the media. It was written, a reporter called Jim Wilworth had contacted John. I told John the second he told me that he was being involved with Time magazine, I said, don't do it. They have nothing but enmity for you. Nothing at all. And you will not be pleased with what happens. But he did it anyway. I noticed the picture of him was colored green. And I thought to myself at the time, I couldn't believe that he would have let that happen. Now it turns out a correspondent, an unknown country reader, has written me about this and said that they took the picture under fluorescent lights with Kodachrome. In other words, they tricked him so that he would be green colored and he wouldn't know it. In the article, it talks about a woman going to a support group of Dr. Max and lying to him about his experience, her experiences, him believing her, and that therefore everybody was a liar and we were all in a cult and John was a fool. Then it turns out that this so-called witness was Jim Wellworth's army buddy's wife, so says this correspondent who was kind enough to write me this whole story. In other words, the Time magazine was all a setup, the Time magazine piece. So this was a man who was hated and despised by the media, certainly by the Air Force, by the same way all of us are. They hate us because we represent a truth of their failure, and it's a profound failure. At worst, because they started shooting at the visitors in the late 40s, we have ended up in a situation where we have been denied contact and access to the stars. At best, they can't protect us from something malevolent, because they certainly cannot do it. In either case, they lie and lie and lie. John Mack did not lie. John Mack was an honest man. He was also a very rational man, scrupulously rational. So as you listen to this interview, remember what's in both of our minds. First, my admiration for John and my gratitude toward him, because while John lived, the close encounter experience gained a dignity that it never had before and has not had since. John had just come off the Time magazine disaster. He was under enormous amount of pressure in his professional life during this interview, and it's a phenomenal interview. It's extremely interesting. He does an excellent job, and I sound strangely youthful, so enjoy it with me. And thank you again for being part of Unknown Country and being subscribers and keeping on, because we're after the truth here. And it's hard because people hate the truth. The weak hate the truth, like the Jim Wilworths of the world and the Time magazine editors, these little bottom feeders. So here we go. The old Dreamland theme still unchanged after all of these years. And then Whitley Strieber and John Mack.
This is a special edition of Dreamland with Art Bell. Now, filling in for Art, here's Whitley Strieber.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. Tonight we have a great show. We are privileged to have Dr. John Mack, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Abduction and the new book, Passport to the Cosmos. Dr. Mack is a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, founding director of the Program for Extraordinary Experience Research, and, in my opinion, now the world's leading authority on alien abductions. You will find out things from him and from his incredible new book tonight that you did not know before, that are going to make you realize that this is something worth thinking about very, very hard. You know, after I wrote Communion, I experienced what it was like to be a pariah and a national laughingstock. I had the experience of going on the Larry King show, sitting 2 feet away from Larry, and having him laugh in my face. I could smell his breath in front of his 2 million listeners, or watchers, I should say. It was hideous. It was agony. Then Dr. John Mack, M.D., Harvard professor, Pulitzer Prize winner, suddenly did something so extraordinary and so brave, it changed my life, Bud Hopkins's life, and the life of everyone who had ever had a close encounter and experience and was agonizing over it in one way or another. Derision ended. People began to take another look at this. They began to say, hey, maybe there's something in it. John Mack went to the wall for this. He nearly lost his license. He nearly lost tenure. He nearly ended up out on the street without a career, without a job. All on behalf of the fact that there is something extraordinary about the abduction experience. Tonight, we're going to have a conversation with a real hero, a hero of science, an American hero. When we come back, my hero, Dr. John Mack. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. This is Whitley Strieber. We're back. Dr. John Mack is with us. John?
Hey, Whitley.
John, you just came back from a trip to India.
Right.
Right. We'd love to hear a little bit about what happened there. Why did you go to India?
What happened was that a group called Synthesis put together delegation of about 30 people with 70 supporters of that delegation at the invitation of the Dalai Lama to take a look at where we're going in the future, what can be done to address some of the conflicts in the world, some of the suffering that's going on, and every field was represented there, economics, politics, science, medicine, the media, education, and we spent several days, and His Holiness was deeply involved in this, and rarely that he gives that much time, and most of us were inspired to take back a kind of wisdom that we always receive when we meet with him, because he, on the one hand, he has such a complicated job being both the spiritual as well as the political head of the Tibetan people in their time of crisis. At the same time, he's a simple, loving human being without an attitude of vengeance and a great caring and very inspiring. And I think what we were able to bring was a sense that there are people in all these major fields who are with him and his values and ideals and with the Tibetan people. And this was an extraordinary time.
Why were you particularly invited?
Well, I knew the organizers well because we had worked together on something called the Parliament of World Religions in the summer of 1993. Brian Muldoon and Barbara Bernstein were the chief organizers, and they were particularly interested in people that were doing work that was on a kind of edge, whatever their field might be, questioning the economic system and economics, and in my situation, questioning really philosophical questioning of reality, questioning of what is the nature of the universe. They are very familiar with the work I've done with people who've had these extraordinary experiences, and they felt that that was an important area of possible transformation and change.
Was the Dalai Lama aware of the nature of your work?
Yeah, because we had met with him in 1992. He's had an interest in this all along, and he sees this as an area that could mean something in terms of Western consciousness and for the Tibetan people, or for Tibetan philosophy and religion. The universe is filled with beings of all kinds, some of whom can manifest in the physical world. So this is not an extraordinary matter for them. But the fact that this is gaining attention in the West is an extraordinary matter. So that was particularly what's been interesting to him, and how this can open up Western thinking to appreciate a much different kind of universe.
Well, it certainly is extraordinary to me, because I have, as you know, had experiences with beings that could be both physical and not physical. Being from a Western background, I was pretty surprised to discover that actually was real.
So the problem we have in our philosophy in the West is we have a very vastly oversimplified notion of reality. Either it's literally physical, just like everything around us that you can touch and feel and smell, or it's in the realm of the imagination and then not materially real, but something that is in some senses not there physically, or comes from another dimension and we don't know where, and then manifests in the physical world. We don't have any place for that in the philosophy that has grown up in the last several centuries in the West, but that's not true in Tibetan culture or any of the philosophies and religions of the Far East.
Well, that's right. And so they're much more comfortable with this. And you, throughout Passport to the Cosmos, which, as I will be saying many times during the course of this program, folks, there is a remarkable deal on. You can get a signed copy of this book, signed by John Mack. And you don't have to go to a bookstore. You don't have to go to a book signing. You don't have to hope he's coming to your town. What you can do is you can go to www.peermack.org. That's P-E-E-R-M-A-C-K.org.
I think there's a hyphen between the peer and the Mac. I'm told.
Well, it works all right without the hyphen.
Does it?
Yeah,
okay.
I'm on it right now, and I'm looking at it, and it's fine. But you can do it with a hyphen too if you'd like. And
have it well drilled by my supporters at home.
Right. Go to Peer Purchases. Click on Peer Purchases, and you can get this book. And the price for a signed copy is an amazing $20. That's $4 off the regular bookstore price for a signed copy of Passport to the Cosmos. And let me tell you, I have read this book cover to cover. You know as well as I do that I don't read every book that we talk about on this show cover to cover. I read every word of this. It is awesome. Do not assume that it is a sequel to Abduction. It is far beyond that. John Mack has made a major breakthrough. Let's go on now, talking a little bit more about that breakthrough. One of the things that's so extraordinary about this book is the way you integrate indigenous people's ideas and attitudes about this abduction experience throughout the book. Credo Mutwa, a leading African sensui or high medicine man, his ideas and his stories go through the whole book, and they are truly amazing. We always think of this as being basically an American thing, or at best a Western thing. But John Mack has blown that idea out of the water. They're doing it, and doing it better, in other parts of the world. So tell us a little bit about this man. How did you meet him, and what was he like, and what happened to him?
Actually, I hadn't expected to meet him when my associate, Dominique Kalamanopoulos, and I went to South Africa to, or actually we were headed for Zimbabwe because there had been some children at a school outside the capital of Harare who had some extraordinary sighting of of UFOs that had landed in their schoolyard, and they'd seen one or more strange beings, as one of the girls put it, come out of these spacecraft. And we received some drawings of these kids by fax and telephone calls, and so we were already planning to go to Africa, but we changed our plans to make sure we went to that school. But we also planned to went to South Africa for a week, and right then and there, I was met at the airport, and we were taken to a television station, and there by satellite was Credo Mutwa, because he had heard that I was going to talk about these experiences with these strange beings, which he calls, or his people call, Mentindane, which, but to hear him describe those beings is very much like the gray beings that we hear so much about here. And for the first time, he then he has to see me, and then he we spent several hours with him, and he, for the first time, in a very movingly candid way, talked about the trauma that he'd undergone when he was a young man in the bush, and had been through an experience very much like the ones that you've been through, Whitley. And and at that time, I mean, I had never heard of Credo Mutwa, and here within hours, really, of landing in South Africa, I was with this extraordinary medicine man talking about experiences so familiar to me from people in this country.
This, which is quite extraordinary. I am shown that the world is dying. These creatures are trying to warn us about danger. The thing that you are looking into is real. It is not a figment of anybody's imagination. This was part of the message of Credo Mutwa, and it certainly is related to the kind of messages that I have been getting, and the book that Art and I wrote, The Coming Global Superstorm, is a direct response to that kind of message. What do you think this means, John? This is something you discuss quite a bit in the book as well, this message that seems to be beginning to focus. If you could describe the message that's focusing around the abduction experience, around this part of our ongoing contact, what would you say it is? How would you?
Well, you have to start with a certain mentality which pervades the Western way of thinking, but it's common throughout the world, which is that the planet is a kind of piece of real estate that belongs to us, and that we can divide it up into countries, and it's a marketplace for goods and for all kinds of resources, and we have no responsibility beyond what we take from the earth. And in other words, we act like the earth essentially belongs to this one species. And that's changing, of course, with the increasing environmental awareness, but we've reached the place where basic resources are running out. The planet is becoming more and more polluted. The seas, the yield of fish from the seas is going down. And in effect, we are in an extraordinary planetary crisis because of our inability to understand what native peoples all over the world understand, which is that there is a very delicate web of life, and that that web of life is being destroyed by this species. So that's the background. But then what happens in these experiences is that the message comes through to people that have had no particular environmental sensitivity or awareness, and the message says, your planet is dying. This is not your planet. It does not belong to this one species. And they are shown images of vast and exquisite beauty of the planet all over the earth, and then those images are shown alongside of pictures of the sea polluted, the trees dying, species disappearing, and they often react with shock to the to when they see this, and it creates a very deep sadness, but at the same time a strong motivation on the part of many experiences. If they can get past the trauma, the initial trauma of the experiences, that they become very motivated to do something about this situation. They want to talk publicly about it. But again, many of them are so used to, you said at the beginning that you spoke about derision and ridicule, and that's a big problem, because this phenomenon is so frightening to many of us in the West. Not so much because of what the aliens do or don't do to people. That's a part of it. But the deeper fear is that it tells us something about ourselves in the universe that is completely shattering to our worldview. As it says that there are beings, creatures, whatever you want to call them, intelligences, who have powers, who have vision, who have intelligence and technological capabilities that we simply don't have, and that they can reach us and do with us what they will. I mean, what they do is not that destructive, but the fact that we are not in control, that there are other beings that come through to us in this way, I mean, it kind of topples the arrogance that is pervasive, in the sense that we are alone somehow in the universe, and intelligence is, we are the smartest beings in the cosmos, and this is a shock to discover that what native peoples all over the world, of course, have known and still know, and we used to know this too, that the universe is filled with beings, with intelligence, which don't necessarily manifest in the material form, although they may. This is opening people to this kind of awareness. But the point is that people are afraid to speak up about this, because the tendency is to be laughed at or in some way embarrassed for speaking about what is a deep truth for these individuals.
Yes. On Tuesday, November the 16th, something very extraordinary is going to happen at 7 o'clock in the evening. This is going to be the moment when Dr. John Mack, author of Passport to the Cosmos, Pulitzer Prize winner, is going to be speaking at the New York Academy of Medicine. It's at 5th Avenue and 103rd Street. It's $20 or $10 with a student ID. Doors open at 6 p.m. To reserve tickets in advance, you can call 212-459-4570. If you're anywhere in the Northeast, don't miss this. I would fly in for it.
There also will be with me one of the people I've worked with. We call them experiencers. I don't like the term abductees, because that implies kind of violence and being taken against one's will. And in addition to one of the experiencers who will be on the podium with me, our clinical director, Roberta Colasanti, will also be speaking. And it should be interesting, I think, to particularly... Also, there will be some experiencers in the audience who will speak up. So it'll be a kind of well-rounded program. them, I hope.
It's a chance to get insight into what is probably one of the most important human experiences in all of history. Tuesday, November the 16th at 7 p.m. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be back. This is Whitley. I'm back. We're talking to John Mack, Dr. John Mack, the Harvard professor and psychiatrist who brought legitimacy to the whole alien abduction experience. His new book, Passport to the Cosmos, is a breakthrough book from Crown. You can get a signed copy tonight if you go to www.peer-mac.com or .org. That's www.peermac.org. Click on Peer Purchases and you'll be able to order, not for the cover price of $24, but for just $20, a copy of John Mack's book, Passport to the Cosmos, signed by Dr. Mack. When we get back, we're going to be talking about one of the subjects that is one of the most difficult subjects for me personally to talk about. When I was reading Dr. Mack's book, I was astonished to find myself quoted some things I had said to Dr. Mack about this particular subject, which is sex. And I thought long and hard about whether or not I would even bring it up tonight. I'm very shy about it, but I think it's really important to talk about this and to talk about fear. And if we can talk to Dr. Mack about this tonight, I think we're really going to learn something very, very new. He's made some real breakthroughs in terms of his insight and his understanding of what's happening in both of these areas. The close encounter experience, as it really is, John Mack is probably as close to the truth about this as anyone ever has been. This is Whitley Strieber. We'll be back in just a few minutes with John Mack. I would like to quote from your book, John. The sexual part of my relationship with the beings has been very complex and very rich and very difficult at times because I'm a married man. I've taken marriage vows, which I believe in. To an extent, this aspect of it has been thrust on me, and it's not something I've been able to control. If it had been under my control, I would have felt very guilty. It's like having a second wife with whom I have a secret relationship. I would wake up in a state of sexual excitement in mid-intercourse. The physical dynamic is different in the sense that the sensation of intercourse moves through your whole body and you become totally devoted to it for longer than I do in normal intercourse. It's as if a level of sexuality I'm not normally involved with is engaged. It's very, very powerful. Of course, that I'm quoting myself, as you know. Let's talk about this side of this experience, because you cannot really engage the close encounter experience unless you engage its sexual content, I don't think.
What we had heard, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
I had heard before I got deeply into this was that the sexual part of it was a kind of a workman-like professionalism on the part of the beings who would take sperm from the men by some sort of rubbing or with some kind of equipment, and eggs were taken from the women, and a hybrid species was created. And a lot of people have that kind of experience, although I think that in the early years of investigating this, that was more common than it is now, that this kind of traumatic, cold sort of experience. But little by little, I began to find that if you work with people more intensely and you stay with the fear and you allow them to go through this kind of dark night of the soul, we sometimes call it an initiation that people go through, the experience shifts and the terror gives way and the people discover that they have a deep connection with these beings. it's still a mystery where this connection comes from, what it's about, whether it's the future of our species coming back in some form, whether, or it's a evocation of some kind of deep truth from human history. I really don't know. But what emerges is, and you know, one might say, well, you know, it's something special about you, Whitley, but it's not.
No, I know it's not. That's why I brought it up.
I've heard that story from many people. There's a whole section in the last chapter of the book called Parenting on the Other Side, in which there is a usually one other being that the human has a very strong connection with, a very deep connection, which may or may not have an erotic part to it, but it is a very deep, intimate, close, and often sexual kind of experience, which has a very different quality than sexuality. So when people say, well, you write about sex with aliens, you know, ho, 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 it's really not like that. It's a much more transcendent, often highly spiritual, and
yes,
in a sense, very odd relationship, because it's not based on, like, a physical attraction. It's a much deeper kind of soul, intimate relationship that seems to be on the other side of this terror that people go through. And I haven't, you know, I don't think we have enough information now to know that this lies on the other side of the terror for every individual, but I've certainly come across it over and over again now, more recently.
Well, one of the things that comes up inevitably in, when you're talking in, about this is the idea of hybrids, of there being children that emerge out of this part of the experience. Do you have a sense, are we talking about something real or something that's somehow a metaphor? For example, you said that the sexual content of it was somehow or another related to the spirit, and I would agree with that totally. It's almost as if if your soul could have sensation, these are the sensations it would have. So what about the hybrids? What does that mean to you?
Well, I think you're asking a question that has to be asked. In other words, there's a danger when you talk about this phenomenon to start making the whole thing quite literal. In other words, we talk about beings, we talk about erotic relationship, as if this is somehow occurring in the same material sense that our everyday lives occurs. And it's really not like that. We don't know, for instance, even though people have had hundreds of thousands of people may have had this experience of having somehow participated in the creation of hybrids. We don't know that these hybrids exist in a literal physical way. For instance, if you were to sort of go up into the heavens and look inside a UFO, there would be hybrids being created. We don't have any tangible physical evidence of the existence of these hybrids. So we have to be very cautious about making this too literal a matter. We have fundamentally the experiences that people have had, and these are people of sound mind. I mean, I should say that really clearly. We've done very careful psychological and psychiatric examination of these individuals. We've done comparison studies, control studies. There isn't any indication that there's a psychiatric explanation of this phenomenon, nor is there any suggestion that this is somehow something people have taken in because they've watched too many television shows or seen too many movies that have to do with aliens. On the contrary, the filmmakers go to the researchers to get their material so they can make the movies. So it is in some way a very real experience, but the problem is that we are so limited philosophically in the West that it's either literally and physically real, or it's just imagination that doesn't exist. But what do we do when people of sound mind have powerful experiences that affect their bodies? They'll talk about the profound vibrational experience that occurs, and yet we cannot prove it from a literal physical point of view. What do we do with that? I think that's one of the struggles that people who work in this field have, because we don't really have one might call a science of experience, or what Robert John, a researcher at Princeton, calls science of the subjective. That we think of science as demonstrating the physical objective reality. reality of something. And there are physical dimensions to the abduction experience, but it's not only physical. It seems to come from some place that is beyond the veil.
It's kind of both.
Term.
What? Like I've had experiences that were just extraordinarily physical, and others that weren't, and some that started out in non-physical became physical. I think all of us are in the same boat. We those of us who are having this experience, often you can't even tell whether it's physical or not. It's just so intense and overwhelming and powerful, and you're left in a state of kind of glorious shock, and you don't know where it's coming from. It's coming from everywhere all at once.
Yeah, I mean, it's but the thing that science struggles with in this country is that we don't know what to do with something that is an experience, is very powerful, has a physical element, experientially a physical element, may even have some subtle physical signs, marks on the body, cuts, scoop marks, and yet the physical element cannot be demonstrated or proved by the methods that science is accustomed to. So what do we do with that? We can't dismiss it, or we shouldn't dismiss it, because from a human point of view, it's as powerful as anything we know. And yet we can't nail it down in the way that science prefers. So we have this kind of crisis, in a way, a crisis of knowing.
There is a quote in the book that really stunned me, and I'm going to read it right now. I wouldn't try to publish a scientific paper about these things because I can't do any experiments. I can't make glowing raccoons appear. I can't buy them from a scientific supply house to study. I can't cause myself to be lost again for several hours. But I don't deny what happened. It's what science calls anecdotal, because it only happened in a way that you can't reproduce, but it happened. Now, what so amazed me is that this, what appears to me, John is going to tell us the whole story, to be a description of missing time and a face-to-face encounter with the Greys, was written by a Nobel Prize laureate, Carrie Mullis, about an experience that occurred one night in 1985. Can you tell us, John, a little bit about this, since we are in the process of discussing why science seems unable to study this?
Well, Dr. Mullis didn't write a great deal about this in his autobiography, but apparently he was in the woods one night, and there were these kind of glowing raccoon-like figures, and they were very real for him. He then, as he's in this quote, he missed several hours. It was so real that he went back into the woods to try to find these beings or some indication of them, and he couldn't. Yet he knew what he had experienced. So he's like many of the people who have these experiences. People say, "Well, you can't prove it," but they can't prove it. They just know, you know, like Ellie Arroway in the film Contact, where she says, "Everything I know about myself tells me that this happened, that this is real." And the people that have been through that, they don't care whether you can prove it or not. It's true for them. It's powerful for them. They know they are of sound mind. Someone like me can verify that they are of sound mind. And the meaning and power and significance of this phenomenon is there, whether or not you can prove it in a literal physical way, like Dr. Mullis says. Now, another point that needs to be made, these raccoons, these bright raccoons, that's very common.
Yeah, I've seen them myself.
First report that what they saw were some sort of an animal. They saw an animal, a raccoon, a deer, birds, big birds, owls, whatever. But then when you go more deeply into the experience, it turns out that this is a kind of mask, a kind of disguise for something else, which is these strange beings. And this is interesting because these animal figures, these, I found out from a South American medicine man who's also I write about in the book, these particular animals that are the disguises that the beings take are also animals that have spirit significance for those particular individuals. Now, the indigenous people, the native people, they know who their power animals are. So, and they, this Bernardo Peixoto, who's in the book, who's a South American, a Brazilian shaman, he says that they can tell which are the Ikuyas, which are these beings, which may come disguised as an animal that is the power animal or significant animal for somebody, or whether it, let's say, shows up as an owl, or is it really an owl? In other words, they can tell the difference. But there is some way in which this phenomenon drives consciousness and into a place that is very similar to the consciousness that native people have.
I agree with that totally. The deeper you get into it and the longer it stays in your life, the more awe and respect you have for the accomplishment of indigenous mankind, as it were, and the way they have succeeded in penetrating into other dimensions. It's just, they're really awesome people.
I had the experience about 5 years ago, which was very heartening to me because I was under a fair amount of criticism, or, you know, I couldn't prove all of this, and, you know, it was, how do you know these experiences are real? How do you decide what's real? You know, there was a strong challenging of this, and I was under, as you said earlier, under a lot of pressure. And
you'd rather have your life wrecked.
Well, it was not that bad, but...
Sure scared me.
But a number of native people came, called me to help me. As they came forward, they said, look, we know about this. This is commonplace in our lives. This is Native American. And we know about these beings. We've had these experiences. And it turns out that, Sequoia Trueblood, who's in the book, is a Native American, medicine man. I asked him, well, you know, Sequoia, you know 150 medicine men, or so, and in your life, how many of them have had these kind of encounter experience? He said, all of them.
Wow. All of them.
And I found that very supportive because they came, you know, they hadn't talked, they don't talk publicly about this. I guess it's hard enough to be a Native American. You don't have to get labeled a UFO abduction on top of it, you know. So they keep, it's also sacred. They don't talk about these things unless they have reason to.
When I lived in upstate New York, I had two men who came who said to me that they were Delaware Indians, and I have no reason to doubt them. And they wanted to show me something in the woods that I owned at that time behind my house. And they took me back into those woods and showed me a place which turned out to be a place where a number of Delaware medicine men were buried. And as a result of being shown this, I had put in the deed the fact that these, or in the conservation easement that was on the land, that these graves could never be dug up for archaeological reasons, and so that they would be forever kept. And I used to go out there at night, and very often in that particular area, that you would see the graves. I must say that it was never a really direct physical experience, but there was certainly something going on there in that particular space. And I felt like, you know, that these people, the graves were ancient and huge trees growing out of them. And I thought to myself, how long have these people kept in the privacy of their tribal memory the knowledge of this, of these graves? Probably hundreds of years or maybe even more. So it's That culture, even in the United States, as oppressed as the Native Americans are, they're still very much attached to the land and to their own past, and there's some kind of a connection between them and this.
Well, in some ways, these beings sometimes seem like the protectors of the earth, and sometimes experiencers are given information by the beings that they are messengers from source.
Okay.
Source of God or the divine to protect the earth.
When we come back, the lines will be open west of the Rockies, 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. This is Whitley Strieber, It's Dreamland. This is Whitley Strieber, Dr. John Mack, Harvard psychiatrist, M.D., Pulitzer Prize winner, author of The Groundbreaking Abductions, and now Passport to the Cosmos, the book that is going to begin the process of really understanding what is going on. John Mack is in contact. He is making sense of contact, something I never thought would happen in my lifetime. When we get back, it'll be your phone calls, your chance to talk to Dr. John Mack. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and we'll be back. Okay, we're going to go straight to the phones. Craig in Washington, D.C.
Hello?
Hi, Craig. You're on the air. You got a question for Dr. Mack?
I'm so thrilled to be on. I love the show.
Thanks.
It's very nice to talk to you guys. And I just want to make an initial comment. The hourly news that we have to listen to when you do your breaks, I hate that. It gives you such a weird perception of reality. Whitley,
it's interesting that you say that.
You were the communion guy, right?
Right.
This movie, it really gave me yet another in a long stream, apparently, thin slice of enlightenment. You really have helped me out in certain ways, and I really appreciate that movie and its documentation.
Thanks.
Now, my question is, Doctor, are there people that are alive in society right now who actually live with the knowledge of all the wiring under the board of life, of everything? Is that possible? Somebody completely aware?
Well, it depends what you mean. I mean, if you mean are people like know everything, you know? I mean, sometimes you meet people and think they do, but that's not really what you're asking. I think you're asking something else, you know, as if somehow through their experiences they've been opened up to some kind of vast field of knowledge, something like that. I think you're asking. Say more about your question. I'm not sure I'm getting the whole thrust of what you're asking.
It's just like there seems to be people at certain key positions in society, in life, in culture, especially in the United States, that seem to be opening up people's minds in a big way. Have you ever heard of the magician named David Blaine?
No, I don't. I haven't.
I haven't either. Tell us a little bit about him.
He's had a couple of, like, ABC specials or something. I'm not sure of the network. I just remember this guy's show. And he just does his, like, man-on-the-street magician acts. But saying magician acts is kind of discrediting the guy, because he goes out and does instant psychic stuff with people he picks at random. I mean, some of the tricks that he does, some of the I don't know what even word to use to describe what he actually puts on camera, but they are illusions or tricks or some sort of mind play that are too beyond reality to dismiss. You can't dismiss them. I can't even describe them to you.
I see what you're asking about psychics. No, I think there's something there. I mean, I've personally had experiences with psychics that knew things about me that there was just no way they could have known. I mean, some of the best psychics just tune in. There's just no way that they could have gotten that information from any other source. I mean, there are many, many situations I've seen like that, and they have a capacity to somehow open up to the consciousness field of another person and get tuned in. It's whether it's telepathic or it's part of what the Hindus call the Akashic Records, or that, in other words, all knowledge is somehow registered and you just have to find a way to tap into it. I don't know, but there are psychics that know things that that they have not been told by the usual means of communication.
It's like this guy has otherworldly airs, and I just think that there are all levels of society and business and commerce and major religions. I think that it's all there. Do any of you know what the Illuminati are?
You know, that's a very interesting question, and I can address it for a very strange reason. I never really believed there was such a thing as the Illuminati, but I think I was once approached very subtly by the Illuminati. I was at the house of a man out in the Pacific Northwest, and he quite casually showed me an initiation manual for the Illuminati that was printed in 1910, and I don't think I've ever seen or heard of the existence of such a book before or since. I'm going to have Robert Anton Wilson on this program sooner or later. He's the expert on this issue of, are there illuminated individuals? Is there anybody out there who really knows the whole truth? You know, people in this close encounter experience tend to be full of questions rather than answers. The ones that are full of answers are usually kind of scared of facing the fact that we don't know what the heck's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, this is a real mystery. I mean, I think that's part of the, I guess you're going to have other callers, so I'll hold my comments. Why don't you take another caller? Thanks, Craig. Oh,
yeah, thanks very much, Craig. It was a good call. Okay, Carl. The last time Carl was on, and he's been very patient, he's called many, many times since then, we challenged him. And
absolutely.
He is going to respond now to that challenge. Hi, Carl.
Hello, Willie. Hello, Dr. Mack.
Hey.
I met you both at the 97 Roswell meetings. I met with you briefly at the bathroom, and I gave you an extinction cycle letter.
Which one of us are you talking to?
To Dr. Mack.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The reason that we have this extraordinary visitations of all of these different aliens is that we are their creators, not the other way around. There are certain classes of these aliens that are tampering with our genetics, i.e. trying to interbreed and crossbreed and escape a purification and cleansing that is coming to our Earth. This is part and parcel of the extinction cycle of events that I spoke to you about, Whitley, several months ago.
Carl, tell us about where your sources come from, how you get this information.
I am the true Messiah. I am the creator of creators. In my genes, in my genetic makeup, is the restoration of the gene pool that we require, and that is one of the three...
Carl, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
When you say this, and this is sort of your spiel, you say this whenever you come on the air, or a version of it, are you really saying... Are you speaking for all mankind, or is this a personal thing?
For all life in the universe, Whitley.
Okay. So, in other words, what you're saying is that this is not Carl. This is, you are expressing the meaning, in your words, the meaning or the sense of all living creatures.
Yes, I am the father of all life in the universe.
No, but his question is,
and
are
again,
you saying that you as
an
individual are, or are you as a participant in the whole cosmic fabric or human race or whatever?
I am the creator of creators.
As an individual, you mean?
Not as an individual, per se, but in my genetics is encoded.
Right. Would you say that of each of us? In other words, could I say that of myself or Whitley of himself?
Each of you are co-creators in this endless universe.
Yeah,
and
okay,
you are the forefathers and foremothers of these alien beings that are back tampering with our genes. Now, there are two classes of alien beings that are literally tampering, i.e. crossbreeding, with our species. And they themselves are from our own ancient futures. And they are trying to keep their creators, which are the evil and the wicked on this earth, alive through what we have coming ahead of us now.
So you've seen this in your... Well, you've had visions of this. Is that it?
It's in my blood because...
The knowledge is something that you just sort of know, or you've been informed of this, or...
It's genetically encoded in my genes, and each of us has some form of that left. Even my own genes are polluted. But, we're short on time here, and I can't explain all that to you now.
Okay, Carl, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was fascinating and strange and maybe true and maybe we don't know. But we do know we have a number of other callers. Let's go to Jim in Las Vegas. Okay, Jim? Oh, excuse me. Ian in Visalia, California. You're on the cell. Ian? Okay, you're on the air.
Well, first of all, I just wanted to make a comment about the Illuminati.
Yeah?
The Illuminati are simply the people that are of a higher spiritual nature. They're more cerebral than other people. That's all they are. They're not a clique. They're just people that are of a higher mental order.
Okay, do you have a question for Dr. Mack?
Have either of you ever had an out-of-body experience?
John?
Actually, I have. I can't say that I have. I mean, I think that...
I was poisoned with LSD, strychnine, and methamphetamine.
Who did that to you?
Some guy that didn't like people in the military during Vietnam when I was on leave and gave me some of that.
This is when you were in Vietnam?
No, I was home on leave.
I mean, you had served in the Vietnam War, and then
during the Vietnam War, yeah. But I was home.
I heard from reliable people that there was.
I was in a hospital. I was lying on a hospital bed at the time in Denver, Colorado, and I felt my whole body just became rigid and cold. And suddenly, it was just like if you know what a fisheye lens looks like through a camera.
But someone gave you LSD without your knowledge or without your agreement?
No, we were three guys, and we knew we were going.
Ian, we got to keep going because we got a load of calls here.
I'm trying to explain something to you.
Okay, well, let's do it.
What happens? Hello?
Yeah, we're here. We're all listening to you, but you got to do it.
What happens is that you just—it's just like a flash. All of a sudden, you're up above everything, and you're looking down as if you were looking through a fisheye lens.
If you have a question to ask, ask it because we got to
move
on.
It's not a question. I'm telling you what it's like because I've lived through it.
Thank you very, very much for your comment, and we're going to go to Jim in Las Vegas. Jim, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'm from Penn State University, but I'm in Las Vegas right now.
Right.
We
got a question for Dr. Mack?
Several of your phone calls. Now, look, I know there's very short time between, you know, when I get a chance to talk and when the break is. But I would like Dr. Mack, first of all, to help me with this. I have a friend whose wife underwent a near-death experience. She wants to divorce him. Why would a near-death experience cause a divorce?
I don't know. I mean, I think that there are a number of kinds of experiences that people have that are so profound that it can change their whole life, their whole sense of their relationships. I mean, I would have to know a lot more about it, but there are a lot of people who have had abduction experiences who end up getting divorced, too, because it means there's a whole new dimension in their lives which a spouse may not be able to go along with. I mean, you have to know the individual situations. I mean, I see it all the time when families have a great deal of conflict and stress when one person's had the experience and the other hasn't, and it does create strain and does require that the spouse adapt to it's as if you have a new person that they're married to, so... I mean, you'd have to. I don't know that person's own situation, but I mean, that does happen.
Thank you very much for your call. Okay, we're going to go straight to the phones. Janos in Wakefield, Vermont. Janos, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Janos.
Hi, Whitley.
Yeah, you're on with me and Dr. Mack.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hey.
I've been listening for the last 45 minutes. I tuned in. You were talking about the Illuminati and the Greys. Kind of a tie-in with...
Okay, well, we weren't, actually, but that sort of came up in the conversation, but sure, what's your question?
Well, I've been researching and pursuing the Illuminati for about 15 years. Benjamin Franklin was an Illuminati.
Should be understood, by the way, that was an order of the Masons. I mean, it's not exactly a secret.
Well, I'm not saying it is. I was... doing this in California when I was living there, and I've worked myself up from the first degree to a 32nd.
Mason.
Not all 33rd degrees are Illuminati, but all Illuminati are 33rd for some reason, whatever.
Right. Okay, now what is your question?
Well, do you gentlemen, are you assuming that the Illuminati are part of a link between... intelligent forces, intelligent beings that roams the earth and have communication with a certain number of humans.
This touches on a pretty good question for you, John. And the question really is this: is there any kind of organized level of human contact anywhere in the world? And let's include the indigenous populations of the world between us and whatever they are the Greys aliens? Are they whatever they are? Is there any point at which this contact kind of works? Is it organized? Do people understand it in some way, somewhere?
I don't have any evidence for that. The closest that I ever see to that is that sometimes several experiencers, when they get together, will start to compare notes, and they will be able to identify beings that they've encountered that are clearly, at least in their perception, similar or the same as what someone else has encountered. Oh, I know that group, I know those, and that they'll start buzzing with each other when you get the experiencers together about certain beings that they seem to know in common. That's the closest I've ever heard
My query and my quandary is, if there's a common good for mankind relating to these creatures, beings, I would think it would benefit NASA and the whole space program, that they would be pursuing this and bringing it more out. I mean, this is the end of the millennium, and a lot of conversation feedback with this.
What are you asking here? I want to kind of help you this thing.
Well, is there going to be a communion between us?
See where you're going. Okay. I don't know. You know, there is some suggestion, and Whitley, you can comment on this because you've had the experience. There's some suggestion that the very nature of the communication with these beings varies with our consciousness. In other words, if there's an awakening, if there's an, I'm not talking about Illuminati now, I'm just saying there is a kind of opening of consciousness, an awakening, that when that happens, people push through the fear. You mentioned fear before.
Yes.
That the experience itself transforms, it changes, and that there is more of a kind of reciprocity. Now, that doesn't mean that suddenly all these beings are going to reveal themselves in material form on the earth. It doesn't seem to work that way. But the connection improves. It becomes a kind of trans-species communication across some sort of interdimensional divide. That seems to happen. I know people say, why don't they just all show up here, you know. And first of all, the millennium is not a millennium in the cosmos. The millennium is the millennium here because we developed a calendar based on what was considered to be the birth of Christ. And as far as I know, the millennium is not something that's been published in the universe. So it's hard to believe that the cosmos would particularly honor those dates. But as we open, I think as we broaden our knowledge, as we open our consciousness to the existence of other beings, we will have more communication beyond the earth. That's my sense.
Well, a lot of close encounter witnesses in my life, people who are friends of mine, are going in the process of getting to a whole nother level with this. I know I went through a initially terrible fear, then a period of sort of euphoria when I realized that, hey, I can kind of do this, actually. If I keep going out in the woods in the middle of the night and getting myself good and terrified, it's sort of working. I'm sort of getting somewhere. Then I found out about implants, and I went through a couple of years of more fear, and that ended with my reconciliation with the fact that the thing in my ear, which I've talked about on this program a few times, and which was, for those of you who don't know, an attempt was made to remove it surgically. I remember the night it was put in May of 1994 very well. And when the attempt was made, the thing kind of came to life and moved down into another part of my ear, scaring the surgeon and causing him to close the incision. I was then left with the fact. Okay, this is Whitley Strieber. I am back with my ears blown out. I just went down. The ISDN line blew. Unfortunately, as John knows very well, and as the radio network is getting used to the fact that if you're going to have a close encounter witness in the midst of all of this electronic equipment, weird stuff is going to happen a fair amount of the time.
Inevitably. I've been in lecture situations where the whole PA system blew out when there was an experiencer around. And it just, nobody knows how that happens.
Well, this radio network is discovering what that's like, to do that in front of millions of people, which we do it almost every week. Okay, John, let's keep going with our calls because we're coming up on to the top of the hour. Let's go to Janet in Pollock Pine, California. Janet, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Janet.
I've read all of your books and I thoroughly enjoyed them. I'm halfway through Abduction. And
okay, speak straight into the phone, Janet. We can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. I'm halfway through Abduction, and it's really difficult for me to read. It touches a lot of bases. Anyways, the reason I was calling, lately, well, I guess since about April of this year, I've been having some different dreams, let's put it that way, to the point where I'll wake up and I'll be scared out of my wits. Well, a few months ago, I woke up and saw grays right next to the couch where I was laying on. I freaked, and they just disappeared, okay? Ever since then, it seems as though if I have two dreams in a row that have to, well, for instance, I had two dreams in a row that there was going to be earthquakes, and that was the day before, the last dream was the day before the earthquake in Southern California. And then I had two dreams in a row, and I knew I couldn't put my finger on what the dream was about, the content, but it had to do with blood. And the second one, it had to do with blood and a friend of mine. And that same day, he got in an accident. His truck hit a buck and a deer. And so it seems to me that, you know, I know I'm having these experiences, and I've been writing down just everything. You know, my journal has become my best friend here. And
I'm afraid we're going to get cut off, and I want to comment on what you're saying, Janet.
Okay.
Is it okay to jump in here? Because, see, what you're talking about is the relationship between these encounters and certain psychic powers. That's very often reported. That people who have these encounters discover that they have mental abilities that they didn't have before. They have information about what's going on around them. They anticipate tragedies sometimes. They can perceive other people's experiences more sharply. You know, and it sometimes scares them to discover they have these powers.
Definitely scary.
Okay, we've got another call. Let's go to Fritz in Phoenix, Arizona. Thanks very much, Janet. It was a good call. Thanks very much. Fritz in Phoenix. Fritz, you're on the air.
Good evening, Whitley. Excellent program. Dr. Mack, you have survived one of the greatest witch hunts in modern psychiatry organized by some of your colleagues because of ignorance and fear of the unknown. Now, for those old cronies of yours, they were afraid to face reality. They wanted to shoot the messenger. Dr. Mack, all I have to say is focus on the younger upcoming doctors. Pass the torch to them so they can usher in the truth and the understanding that the visitors have arrived.
Well, you're very kind. I appreciate your comment very much, and I don't think it was quite as... I never have felt it's quite as severe what I went through as some people say. I kind of understand how a mainline, mainstream American institution, like the Harvard Medical School would react to one of their professors giving credit to something that must, at least in several years ago, it must have seemed just absolutely outlandish to him. But I'm a clinician, and that's my main work. And I didn't expect this to be true, but I began to see these people, and they're very healthy people mentally, by and large, and they're telling the truth as far as I could say. The only problem was what they were saying isn't supposed to be possible. Well, I decided to stick with what seemed like truthfulness rather than worry about what we're supposed to think is possible or real or not,
Well, you're the messenger, and keep up the good work, because a lot of work has to be done yet. America is somehow still asleep. Of course, the audience on Coast to Coast and Dreamland is very consciously aware of this, but the rest of them have to be woken up, and you're doing a fantastic job, Whitley and Dr. Mack.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks very much, Fritz. It's much appreciated. Well, John, we're coming up close to the end of the program, and if there's something, and I know there will be, because I know you, that you want to leave the listeners with? What is it?
I don't know. I just think it's, it's a lot less frightening to be in a universe that's filled with unknowns, where we don't have control, where there might be something magnificent ahead of us, than to think that we're in a universe that is only material things, and that is that it stops at the border of our skin, in a sense, that our intelligence
right.
stops there. In other words, to be connected beyond ourselves seems to me to be a much more exciting universe than the one that I was raised in, which was that there was no intelligence that wasn't a projection of the human brain. So I think to be open to these kind of experiences, even if they are frightening, is a lot more interesting than closing ourselves off.
Especially because if you stay open to them, I mean, they get less frightening, in fact, and much richer. Although I hasten to add, I know that this experience is a really terrifying experience, and that gets me to this idea. If they are aliens, it would seem if we went to another planet and we found intelligent creatures there, the first thing we would do two things. One, we would be very secretive, and because we would not want to interrupt their culture, we would want to study it and to learn from it and to find what it had to give us before it became totally directed toward us. But then we would want to understand them, and to do that, you go to the genetic material and the sexual material.
Well, they had a lot of trouble. I mean, they often say that they don't understand us. They particularly don't seem to understand our aggressiveness. They don't understand why we have this incredibly beautiful planet, opportunities, and yet we act in such a destructive way. They seem very puzzled about human destructiveness.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Tuesday, this coming Tuesday night, November the 16th at 7 p.m., the New York Academy of Medicine. Dr. Mack at 5th Avenue and 103rd Street in New York City. Dr. Mack is going to be there. To reserve tickets, 212-459-4570. That's 212-459-4570. We've had an extraordinary experience with Dr. Mack tonight. Have an extraordinary experience with him next Tuesday night. This is Whitley Strieber. Will Hilliard is our producer-engineer with Mike Kincaid, Jason Gonzalez here in San Antonio, and Strieber is the producer of this program. Thank you, and good night.